Gabby will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Gabby. I'm an alcoholic. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of characters. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Gabby. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by the information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Brendan.
Is that good? Let's see. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brendan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brendan.
I'm pretty nervous right now, but I don't have to drink because of that today. So, I'm an alcoholic. What that means is I have an allergy to alcohol that, because I'm in a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain all the time, the sensation and ease I get from drinking overpowers anything. Anything, any ideas I have about what I want in life gets overpowered by drinking. So I guess the process of this is to tell you how I was as an active alcoholic, what happened, and how I am now. I say that for you, and I say that for myself, because I will forget how this goes. So I'm pretty impressed when people who can look back in their drinking and know exactly when they cross that line into just being a social drinker into becoming an alcoholic. I never had that line. I have really no illusions about how I am as a drinker. From the first time I had a drink, I was off to the races. I had arrived, so to speak. So I probably had my first drink or drug, I don't even really remember, when I was about 12. I come from South Boston, it's a town not too far away from here, and I'm one of 4 boys. My poor mother, as I'm able to look back and say now. But when a mother bird kind of comes to the nest and she's got a nice fat worm in her mouth and all the little birds are kind of fighting over that worm? That's kind of how it was in my household. It was a pretty dysfunctional place. And looking back now, I can safely say, all the black eyes, all the failed family events and holidays are directly and indirectly because of alcohol. I've been exposed to this stuff for quite some time. So I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And so coming up, I was in a lot of pain. I like to think that I was empathetic and really caring for people because I didn't want them to experience the kind of pain I was feeling. But ultimately, at the root of all that, it was about me looking for a way to not have to experience my discomfort. I would use anything, anyone, in any substance just to feel okay and not feel like myself, because quite frankly, I wasn't confident in my abilities as a person, and I wasn't confident in my abilities as a peer, as a friend, as a son, everything. So on that went, from when I first had my drink, I believe it was about 3 or 4 40 ounces of Natty Ice split between 3 of my buds, and it rolled. I was pretty much, I got a drunk from the beginning, drinking Steel Reserve out of the can as a little kid, skipping school, drinking in between classes and during, you know, before school. And I thought it was okay. I thought it was a cool thing to do. And I really wasn't too worried about it. I was kind of like a live fast, die fast type of kid anyway. So anyways, fast forward maybe 10 years later, I'm 24 now. What happened? Well, came to a point where I couldn't handle anything. Couldn't handle just normal stresses of everyday life. Couldn't have normal conversations with my peers. I couldn't do anything without putting something into my body. And this was going on for a couple of years, of just continuous drug use and drink use. I was a pretty lonely, even more bent out of shape person towards the end of my drinking. So basically, it kind of, first step, I admitted, you know, that I was powerless over alcohol. But the second part is that my life had become unmanageable. I didn't really see that the drinking was the reason why my life had become unmanageable. But I do know that when I was drunk, I couldn't manage my own stuff. When I was sober, I couldn't handle anything because I was too fixated on getting my next fix. In between career opportunities, so I was switching jobs or whatever, and you know, I realized I just couldn't make this decision for myself. You know, I was offered this one job that I really wanted, and on the other hand, I had this other opportunity that my family really wanted for me that I didn't think was the best option. I couldn't choose. I was, you know, here I am, a grown ass man, and I couldn't make a decision for myself, and I knew something had to change. I didn't know what, but I had a good idea that drinking was the common denominator of all my struggles. So I called a friend of mine who I knew was in the program and just said, "Hey man, take me to a meeting." And he did. That was back in August of 2016. I wish I could say that my sobriety date. My sobriety date is January 13th, 2017, making, coincidentally, or not coincidentally, my 90th day of sobriety right now. And thank you. A big part of my program is, you know, sharing what I know and what I've learned from this program with another alcoholic. And in a group as big as this, God willing, I can get that message across to at least one person. So Andrew, thank you for having me speak today. So that's what happened. I got into the program. And the reason why I bring up that the day I got into the program isn't my sobriety date is that relapse is part of my story. Now, that's okay and it's not okay. It's okay because I am an alcoholic and alcoholics screw up. That's what we're very good at. That's what I'm very good at least. I don't condone it. I'm not saying like, hey, you know, you'll get it right, kid. Just a couple relapses and you'll be all right. But this is what I needed to get being into submission. I had thought that, you know, started feeling good after finally being removed from drugs and alcohol. And, you know, the classic story, I thought I had this beat. I thought I was too smart for this disease, and it led to a relapse. So when you separate me from alcohol, right, it still leaves a giant hole, a giant God-sized hole in my stomach that either alcohol can fill or nothing of this world can fill. Not the companionship of my friends, not the companionship of my family. Nothing can fill that hole that gave me the comfort alcohol and drugs gave me. So it was pretty easy for me early on to kind of surrender and give myself to this program because I had no other options. Oh, I was going to die. I knew I was going to die. At least, maybe not overnight, but the way I was going, it wasn't looking too good for me. So I guess it brings us to the last part, is how I am now. I still have a lot of my character defects. I can be really impulsive sometimes. I'm starting to get a little better idea of how to pause so that I can, you know, act instead of reacting or however that goes. But I'm still the same person. It's just I like to think I'm more accountable today. My phone doesn't ring so much from my old friends. But that's a good thing. I think, you know, it shows I'm doing something right and shows where my friendships and where my life was at before I had God in my life and when I was really only living to drink. So I have some really meaningful friendships today. I can be accountable. It's hard, but I'm learning to be honest, something I never thought I could be. And I owe all of that to Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you guys for listening to my story. So thank you. I'm Brendan, I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Brendan. Our second 10-minute speaker is Hannah.
Hey guys, what's up? I'm Hannah. I'm an alcoholic. Which is important for me to remember every day. Because my disease really would love for me to forget it. And alcoholism is a funny thing because I was talking to someone earlier today about seeking and craving. And one of the things that I realized once I started doing steps and started working in this program is that all this time, all along, my whole life, the one thing that's been going on is that I've been craving a spiritual experience. I've been craving a connection with something bigger and greater than me. And because I have alcoholism, I get terribly confused, and I think that drinking and drugging is gonna work and is gonna give me the same peace, ease, and relief that I get from working the steps. And there was a time when that was 100% true for me. There was a time when drinking was excellent. And it probably, if you graphed it, it would be like how good drinking was over time. It's just like that. But so my first experience with drinking was when I was 16 years old. It started a little late. And it was awesome. I was in Europe with a group of teenagers from different parts of the world, and we got some Malibu rum, and I drank some in the bathroom with my friend, who was a great mentor for me. You have to have drinking mentors, too. They're really helpful. She taught me a lot of things. And that night was transformative for me. It was really transformative for me. I went into that experience, and I'd had a really rough year. I'd injured my back on the crew team, and I had to wear a back brace in high school, which meant sweatshirts every day. And I had broken up with the first guy I really had feelings for, and we dated for a year, and so I was terribly down about that. And school was really hard, and just all the stuff going into that experience, actually had symptoms of depression. And then when I started drinking, it flipped. You couldn't hear that. It flipped. And all of a sudden, I was walking down the streets of Florence with purpose and swagger. And we went to this club, and I danced really sexy that night. And it was great. It was phenomenal. And that's what drinking does for me. And I remember coming back from that first summer of drinking in Europe. And I was in the hall, sophomore of high school, so guys, where are we going clubbing? And everyone was like, we can't do that here. But I'm resourceful, right? As alcoholics, we are resourceful. And figure it out. So I started this party persona and alternate personality. And I really prided myself on the fact that if you met me in school, if you met me in class, you'd be like, she is so brilliant. She's so smart. She always raises her hand with the right answer. But if you met me at a party, you would probably think damn, no one drinks like her. And those two things don't go together for most people. But as alcoholics, I think we have this special ability to hold both of those parts. But it didn't last that long. I think the prime of my drinking was approximately 2 years. And thank you. And it spun out of control really badly. The last few months of my drinking, I lived by myself, and I had like my favorite liquor store that I stopped at on my way home and got the same Sauvignon Blanc. I had like a collection of the corks in this big bowl, and they're all the same. And I would drink by myself and watch SpongeBob. Because there's no plot, so it's okay if you forget, if you black out. But it was really lonely, and I had this job of like helping people. Like I had to show up and like help the elderly every day. And I just got to this point, like the culmination of active alcoholism for Hannah is suicidal ideation. And people would be having conversations with me at work, like, oh, next month that would be a really great program and activity. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna be here. So I started like living in that headspace. And I had like another drug of choice that I thought was the real problem. So I stopped that, like I quit that, and I went to a 12-step program for that. And I was doing the 12 steps and I was drinking. Which means that I'm unable to access God. I'm unable to access God with the booze in my body like that. But I was trying really hard. And I learned that it didn't work. So naturally, the next thought is, well, if it doesn't work, I should probably just go back to my drug of choice again. Not like I should go to AA. But that was short-lived, you know? I was sitting on my sofa one day, and I had a sketchbook and a pencil, and I was writing down a list of my belongings and, like, who would get what. So I was mocking up a will in my sketchbook, and I reached out to my sponsor in the other program, and she very gently and lovingly had watched me for months, you know, just delusional. And she said, honey, I think it's about time that you come to AA. And I did. And I came to a meeting on a Thursday night, like tonight, it's Thursday. And then I went to one the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And I started doing step work faster than this woman could meet with me to go over it. Like, we met for step one, and I had, like, made her give me the assignment for step two and finished it already. Because I was in so much pain that I knew from sitting in these seats that there was relief in the steps. I knew that much. So I was like, flooring it with the step work, which was really, really important for me. And I'd done a certain amount of work and contemplation around the higher power GOD piece, which is, I think is very personal. And the really, really big takeaway that I got was that I don't, like, God is so big and so great, and I've got 5 senses in 1 brain. And I kind of just stopped trying to define it. Can't believe I have a minute, wow. So, yeah, I stopped trying to define it, and I made a decision in step 3 to do this work and to do these steps. And a lot has happened to me in the last, you know, almost 3.5 years. My sobriety date's November 2nd of 2013. And in that time, like, I've been unemployed. I've had 2 surgeries without narcotics, which were very painful and brought me extremely close to my higher power. You know, I've sat next to two dying grandparents and held their hands, which was phenomenally beautiful. And, you know, in those types of moments, like, I actually was able to just, like, let the grief hit and move through me in the moment. Like, when emotional stuff happens, like, you can let it move through your body in the moment without it sticking. And there are so many tools in this program that I find indispensable now. So Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I'm so grateful that it works for me because I really didn't have any other options. So I hope that you all stay. Thank you.
My name is Jen and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, welcome to the Beacon Group. If you're visiting from out of town or if you're here for the first time tonight, we are delighted you are here. We will now observe the seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, a $2 donation is recommended so that AA may remain self-supported. While the basket is being passed, please keep in mind that our rent is $600 per month. Please give what you can and see the treasurer's report on the board or our treasurer, Maria, after the meeting. Thanks in advance for your generosity. We have AA literature available on the table in the back. If you don't have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't leave here tonight without one. We also have meeting directories available. Please visit our website, beacongroupaa.com. If you have any questions, you may see Sarah H. after the meeting. Sponsorship is the cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are a newcomer and don't have a sponsor, we strongly suggest that you get one. Please see Christine or Ali after the meeting. They will be stationed by the door. If you are looking to be a sponsor, you may speak to them as well. We have two ongoing monthly commitments. On the second Tuesday of the month, May 9th, we will be going to the Women's Renewal at the Dimmick Center in Roxbury. Please see Carrie, I think, or Sue, after the meeting, if you would like to go. Everyone is welcome. On the third Tuesday of the month, April 18th, at 7 p.m., we will be going to Whitten Hospital in Everett. Please see Evan. Is Evan here tonight? Please see me after the meeting if you would like to go. Everyone is welcome on that commitment. Before I turn the meeting back over to our leader, please remember that there is no smoking on church property. If you smoke or vape, we ask you to only do so on the public sidewalks away from the church entrances, either on Harvard or Marion Streets. There is a receptacle provided for butts, and we appreciate smokers using this. Now I'll turn the meeting back over to Sue.
Also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in much the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Kara has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Kara. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kara.
The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Kara. Tonight, our main speaker is Matt.
Hi, my name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Matt.
And let's see. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what it was like, I grew up a child of relative privilege in a nice white Yankee family with plenty of good-looking things on the outside. Plenty of nice places to go, plenty of vacations to go on, plenty of things to keep us occupied, plenty of things to keep us from being concerned with the little death that was happening in my family every single day. So I grew up, like all of us, with this low-level quest for something outside of myself that I did not understand. I grew up with this feeling like life was happening over there or over there. If I had just been born in a different century, or if I had just been born in a different family or in a different body, then things wouldn't suck. So I grew up, like all of us, a happy, confused, incipient alcoholic. And so I don't know if this is actually a real Bill Wilson quote, but I heard it said one time that he described, he said, the closest thing that most alcoholics ever have to a spiritual experience is what happens when they take the first drink. And when I began to drink, all of a sudden, everything, all of the contradictions, all of the cognitive dissonance that had ruled my life, although I didn't understand it and I didn't conceptualize it in that way, everything, all the noise got quiet and everything felt right. And I know that we have all had that experience. Oh yeah, everything finally feels right. Now I know what I was born to do. So, I had, the first time I smoked pot, I had this fantasy that I was going to go away to boarding school and I would have a footlocker at the end of my bed and there would be a bale of pot. So, I suffer from delusional thinking from the get-go. So, what it was like, I am a child in pain with no idea what I'm looking for. I discover that alcohol makes everything work. I think. And I think I am on the way to living a good and happy life and, you know, earning my pension, getting vested in my options. I have no conception of what I'm going to do, but I know that everything's going to be all right. And then it stops working. And I know that everybody has had this experience because if drinking still made us feel better, then why would we be here? Why would it enter our consciousness that maybe we ought to think about our drinking? Why would it enter our consciousness that maybe we ought to make a major change in our lives? Why would it? So anyway, so what happened was first drinking was great, hooray, then it sucked. And it sucked more, and it sucked more, and it sucked more out of me, and it sucked more of, and I felt like an empty little shell. Like my skin was too tight. Bilbo Baggins says he felt like butter scraped over too much toast. And I always think of that being a really great description of alcoholism and addiction, and it just feels like the way I felt. Anyway, so this is my experience. There's a great Monty Python song that says, I've suffered for my art, and now it's your turn. So, believe me. So this is my experience. I felt like crap at the end of my drinking. Pardon me. I felt terrible. And I did not know what to do. And the only thing that I knew how to do was drink more, consume more substances, engage in more dysfunctional behavior, anything to try and gather up to myself the things that I was giving away to alcohol, the things I was giving away, the experiences of my life that I was sabotaging my way out of. So that's what it was like, you know, and I think that that's... And I think that that's that. So what happened was, unlike many people in my family, I did not have to be institutionalized. I did not have to be electroshocked. I did not have to die in my disease. Unlike many people in the world today, I did not have to seek medication. I did not have to seek an expanding chain of medication. I didn't have to go down the road of trading my prescriptions for street drugs. I did not have to do that. That didn't have to happen to me. But that could be my story. Because we're all the same here on the inside. It's just the skin, just the accoutrements of our lives that are different. You all are much more like me than I would ever want to admit. Maybe that didn't come out right. Or maybe that's exactly what I needed to say. Maybe that was exactly what someone needed to hear. Because when I first... So that did not have to happen to me. I did not have to end my life in tragedy. I did not have to commit suicide like my grandfather. That did not have to happen to me because, as Brendan said, a friend of mine had some experience in sobriety a couple of years before things got really bad for me. And so I watched him change, and I watched him become a different person, and a strange person that I did not understand, but a person who had some experience away from a drink. And I knew that it was possible. So when the wheels completely fell off my life, when I was trying desperately to write a term paper on how we know how to make the decisions that lead us to have a good, happy life, something I was intimately acquainted with as an alcoholic in the bottom of my drinking. Something, you know, good, happy life, something that I was really familiar with in despair constantly. As my life is falling apart, I'm able to call my friend and just tell him that I think I need some help. And I didn't have to say what. I didn't have to finish that story. He got on the bus from Middlebury and came down to Providence and through a huge rainstorm, and he sat even worse. He sat and listened to me blah 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 blah. How you know you have a little bit of experience, but imagine listening to me for 4 hours describing how horrible everything in my life is, how horrible everything in my life will always be. How I was born in the wrong century, born in the wrong body, born in the wrong... And at the end of that, he listened to me and he said, nothing will ever get better in your life until you stop drinking. And I had not been able to listen to very many people. I had not been able to hear many things that many people were telling me, but I did hear that. And I knew somehow that that was the truth, that I really ought to listen to that. And so as a result of that, I was able to become introduced to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to have a wonderful experience of fellowship, and I was able to meet a lot of people and chase a lot of girls and think a lot of people were crazy and continue to live my life in a very self-centered manner and keep God out. But I stayed sober, which was better. And how am I doing for time? To go? All right. Right on schedule. So here's me, filled with hate and discontent, radically self-seeking individual, thrown into a great group of people. So I used my chameleon skills. My superpower was fooling. My superpower was convincing myself that everybody else was fooled by me. I began by. Yeah, great. I began my sobriety by playing groups of people off each other. I would sabotage my schoolwork into such a crisis that I had to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would talk, and then after I had healed a little tiny bit, I would not reach out for the fellowship, for the company, the relief that we provide to one another. I would shut my back. I would mix my ideas. I would turn away from the people who were trying to help me, and I would say, "Oh, I need to go back and finish my work." And I would obsess, and you know, my study skills got worse in college, actually. Many of the kids that I was in my early sobriety group in college with, God bless Bruce Donovan for setting that up. Many of the people in my early sobriety group in college went on to finish their honors theses and get A's in all of their classes. That was not my story. Mine is a story of reverting towards the mean, as it were. So I came into this world thinking that I was all that and thinking that I had you all fooled. And the journey from I am all that and I have you all fooled to where I am now, which is, maybe I'm not so much, but at least I have a chance. It's a long journey. It's a long journey. It's been a long journey for me anyway. So, to keep on track, what it was like, what happened. So that's not the end of my sobriety, obviously. There's only so many years of lousy, untreated alcoholism that even that even a really stubborn alcoholic can endure. I did eventually find a lot of meaning in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did eventually build a bridge toward something greater than myself. I did eventually, you know, use these tools to build a scaffold, you know, to scaffold myself up into some kind of relationship with God. So my God is not the same as anybody else's God. I don't know. But something, you know, so what it was like, what happened? What happened in my sobriety was first I got sober, and then I got crazier, and then I got less crazy. So, and along the way, you know, like my anxiety disorder that I would have fired my shrink over when I was just getting sober, has, you know, my anxiety level has gone way down. I don't itch from the crown of my scalp to the bottom of my, to the soles of my feet when I'm in front of a group of people who might not like me as much as I want them to like me anymore. Not all the time. So what happened was I found a solution to the underlying problem of my life. Thank you. The God-shaped hole that Brendan mentioned, that we use whatever we can to fill it up with, whether that's drinking, drugs, credit card debt, cars, material, houses, stock options, whatever it is, clothes, other people. God, we're terrible at bringing hostages in and thinking that those other people are going to help us. I really truly believe my favorite word in the entire big book is in the ABC propositions, where it says, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Because, you know, we alcoholics, we live in hope. I live in hope that the next human solution is going to be the solution. But if I want to make any spiritual progress whatsoever, I have to give up on that. I have to admit that probably no human power. I don't want to know what I left on the table. But anyway, so what it was like, it sucked at the end of my drinking. What happened? I found a solution here in the fellowship, in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to build a relationship with a higher power in my life that works, that solved my problem. So here I am. You know, what is it like now? What is it like now? I find comfort now in sharing my experience with another alcoholic who needs my help. I find comfort in that. I find comfort. That's our 12th step, by the way. For those of you who are keeping score, I find comfort in prayer and meditation, quiet time. That's our 11th step. I find comfort in admitting my mistakes and moving forward from them. That's our 10th step. You know, I find comfort in that. It used to be the thing that I used to die. I used to be looking for a hill to die on, to try and justify my behavior, to try and convince the people whose faith in me might be evaporating, might not be as strong, who I might not have fooled. I used to look so. Today I find comfort in making amends, in cleaning up my side of the street. I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to clear up something from high school that had been on my mind for 30 years, you know? Not big time on my mind, but on my mind, and had recently come into focus, and I was able to apologize for an action that I did, and I was able to I was able to grow from that. I was able to grow. My heart, what do they say? The Grinch's heart got two sizes bigger that day. I've always felt that I lived in this little fear clench around somebody who's trying to take my heart away. But my heart is growing. I have the ability to recognize that I am that I'm grievously deficient in lots of ways. And I have the ability to ask for help. And to pay attention, and to receive, and to take actions based on that things. So the other thing that gives me comfort now is is working through my, you know, my the defects of character that continue to plague me. 6 and 7. My old sponsor in Vermont, he said that you know, you can't, God cannot enter your life to remove a defective character while you're busy practicing it. And he also said, you know, when you pray for every single defective character to be removed, the ones that you like, the ones that you want to be removed are not going to be removed. Because, you know, because what we're in here is, what we're in here to do is to be useful to another person, to be of use to God and to my fellows. So that's really the biggest thing, you know, that, like, I feel like I am of use now. When I was in my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, somehow they had a sense that I was a newcomer. I don't know why. I don't know how they could have thought that. And they asked me to read the promises, and I felt like they recognized that I had a good speaking voice. they could just tell that I had a good speaking voice. And as I read the promises, what we call the ninth step promises, as I read those words, every single thing that they were promising was like exactly the opposite of what I was feeling in my life. You know, I knew then that there was something in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And a couple of days later, I heard this guy tell this story. Because I'm a prep school, Ivy League, upper middle class kid, and I had a lot to lose. I had a lot still to lose. But, you know, I'm in my first week of sobriety, and I hear this guy who could not have been more different from me. I think he was like at least 6'11", and he had a fifth chapter motorcycle vest on, and he had this little teddy bear in a little fifth chapter motorcycle vest that he had made. Oh, exactly. Here I am. Prep school, Ivy League, whiter than white kid, thinking that I am a tough guy. And here is this guy, broken man, looking at his life, and he bought himself this teddy bear and he made it this motorcycle jacket because he had never had a family. He had never been able to have a relationship with anybody in his life. And he said, the thing that he said was, there's two kinds of alcoholics. There's the kind of alcoholic who loses their house, loses their wife, loses their kids, loses their boat, loses their motorcycle, loses their car, loses everything that ever meant anything to them. And then there's the other kind of alcoholic. And that's the alcoholic who is so busy pursuing their disease, so busy drinking, so busy gathering the stuff of the world into themselves, trying to fill that hole, that they never get kids, they never get a wife, they never get a house, they never get a job, they never get anything that means anything to them. And that hit me right where I live, because nothing in my life of privilege meant anything to me at that point in my life. So, what it was like, it sucked. What happened, things got better. What it's like now, I'm living through the day. What did they say? I'm living the dream. I get a chance to contribute to life. I never wanted to contribute anything to anybody. And now I am afforded with the opportunity, given the gift of helping people on a daily basis. Yeah, great. Living the dream. So things used to, forgive me, that maybe that didn't come out right either. But if you're out there and you heard these people talk about this hole in our soul, this God-shaped hole, and You don't know if it's quite God-shaped, but you know it's there, and you know it's eaten out, and it's growing, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and last year wasn't so awful, but this year is pretty terrible. Just know that, you know, here in these rooms, and here in the pages of these books that we read, and here in the words that we get from our sponsors, when we call them, when we listen to them. I've had 19 sponsors.
Oh.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody who had more sponsors than that, but I'm sure there's somebody out there, because I am just like you all. So, in the words of our sponsors, there is relief. You know, that relief that we were searching for, thank you, that relief that we were searching for, that thing that we thought we had found when we took that first drink and everything went soft focus and all of the problems of the world everything seemed to be at our feet. The relief for what ails us. In the final analysis, it's inside of us. You know, it says, and I think that's the appendix on spiritual experience. You know, we got to look inside, and this is the place that I was taught. This is the place where I learned to look inside, a little by slow, to learn to look inside, and this is the place where I went from being an entitled, elitist, reprehensible individual to being able to stand in front of you and say, and know in my heart that I'm a pretty good guy, that I have that even on a bad day, my ex-wife will say that I'm a pretty good guy. That my kids will say I might fly off the handle, but I'm a pretty good dad. That my manager at work will say might come in late, might be short with people every once in a while, might try to throw his intellectual weight around, but that guy is a pretty good librarian, you know, and that that's what I do these days. I'm a librarian. It's my fourth career, because being a folk hero didn't work out, as Warren Zevon said. Warren Zevon once said, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be the voice of my generation. And then I grew up and I discovered that job was already filled. So I want to be a folk hero. I want to be an actor. The injury that I sustained left me largely unable to remember large chunks of text. So it's hard to be an actor when you can't remember your lines. Didn't stop me from trying, but I wasn't very good. And eventually, I recognized that the product of my talent and my trust fund was not large enough to sustain me indefinitely as an actor. And boy, that was a tough realization. But a realization that I would never have been able to come to had I not had a lot of what my ex-wife calls sober reference. If I had not learned a little bit about myself, I wouldn't have been able to make that choice. So then I tried to be financial information software master of the universe, and didn't work out quite as well as I thought. One of the other things that it's like now is, sometimes some of us have to experience great trauma in our sobriety. Nothing feels worse Nothing has ever felt worse to me in my life than being fired for cause from a job that I knew I was unqualified to have. Nothing felt worse than that afternoon. But I did not have to drink. Nothing felt worse than being told by my wife that she did not want to be married to me anymore. But I did not have to drink. That's how life is sometimes when you're living the dream. There are rough patches. But through it all, we persist and we persevere, and thanks.
Now we have Hillary and Corey for festivities.
All right, Corey Alcoholic. Hillary says her regrets.
Murray Alcoholic.
Okay, announcements tonight. First of all, this group, the Beacon Group, hosts a big book step study meeting called Beacon by the Book. We do that on Monday nights at the Boston Center for Psychoanalytical Studies, which is down the street, 1581 Beacon Street. Everybody is welcome to attend. That meeting does fill up, and we have rules. I don't know, we've been told don't get there before 7:30 because it scares the therapy patients. But you also can't show up right before 8 o'clock because we run out of seats, so figure that out. We go out to eat. We have fellowship for this meeting. We go out to Lee's Burgers, which is down the street on the corner of Harvard and Beacon. We will be leaving right after this meeting to go eat. Anniversary, we do anniversary watches here. I have not been told of any anniversary watches this week. Okay, things that we need to announce. We'll do this tonight.
Yes, totally.
Okay, there is a sponsorship workshop coming up at MIT. This is on Saturday, May 13th. It runs from 10 to 2:30. There's a whole panel of speakers about how to be a sponsor. If you want more information about that, I have that.
It's on the board.
And it's on the board. Okay, our district, so Central Service every year has a fundraiser. They have an annual dinner dance that is coming up. They're bringing in a speaker from New York. And you get a dinner and you get the speaker. It costs $45 and it raises money. It's the main fundraising event annually for Central Service. It is Saturday, June 3rd at the Grand Ballroom in Randolph. And I will be at that if you want more information about that. So the Boston bid for the International Conference of Young People is having various promotional events to raise a little bit of money for their bid. And so they're doing Monster Mini Golf. This is April 14th. They're running a meeting from 9 to 10, and then the golf is immediately after that.
It's at night.
Yeah, they're asking you to wear glow-in-the-dark clothing. They're giving out a prize to the people who has the best glowing outfit. It costs $20, but you get $5 off if you have a piece of AA literature.
Great.
All right.
Saturday, April 29th is the annual Eastern Shore Women's Roundup in Quincy. Okay, last thing. So we're planning we want to decide on the three different things we do in the springtime. So I'm going to do a quick show of hands. You have three choices: volleyball, flag football, and softball. So someone help me keep track of how many people raised their hand for each thing, okay? So pick one, but we'll probably do two out of three. So who wants volleyball? Okay, good. Who wants flag football?
Oh.
Okay. Who wants softball? Okay, it's like a tie between flag football and softball, but that's good information. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, in the fall.
Hi everyone, I'm Paris and I'm an alcoholic. Just have a quick announcement. We are changing job positions in May, and over the next couple weeks, like tonight, we'll be handing out, passing around sign-up sheets. If you didn't get a chance to sign up or you'd like to sign up for a new job, which starts in May, you can see me or Sarah. Thank you.
For CHIPS, we have Carol and Chris.
For Beacon Group members to come and express their gratitude for a minute or so. We suggest that all BP Group celebrants make a donation of $1 per year of sobriety to be sent to GSO. And of course, excellent cake will be served. In an effort to promote unity and enhance sobriety, we here at the Beacon Group sponsor an anniversary watch. This is an opportunity for group members on their 365th day to sit with their sponsor and friends beginning at 9:30 p.m. to watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at Pino's Pizza. If you would like to celebrate your anniversary with us this month, or would like to have an anniversary watch, please see our anniversary person, Sarah, after the meeting.
This has been a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are cordially invited to meet with us again next Thursday and to become a regular member of our group. If you have any questions regarding the Beacon Group or Alcoholics Anonymous, please see any of our members after the meeting. Will all group members please raise your hands? Please remember our custom of thanking the speakers. The line will form to my right. And now, for all who care to join, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.